May I live this day compassionate of heart, clear in word, gracious in awareness, courageous in thought, generous in love. Good morning. Welcome to the seventh session of Word and Life's Fall series based on Bishop Michael Curry's book, Love is the Way. My name is Michael Dean, and I'm a member of the steering committee, and I'm pleased to be your host today. It is my honor to introduce the Reverend Mark Asman, who will be reflecting on chapters 8 and 9, in which Bishop Curry discusses the events and conflicts within the Episcopal Church around issues of sexuality. I could think of no better person to speak to us than Mark, who is the rector emeritus of Trinity Episcopal Church. This is what I wrote to Mark when inviting him to speak to these chapters. Mark, I believe your personal and professional experience and historical perspective position you to speak eloquently to these events. And even more importantly, if there is one theme I have heard from you, far and above all others, in your preaching and in your example, is that God is love. And as children of God, it is the only way we are going to make ourselves, our fellow human beings, and the world a better place. Please welcome the Reverend Mark Asman.
Thank you, Michael, for your kind words and your warm welcome. I love the lightning behind your face. Imagine it's from a few days ago when we had that brief but glorious thunderstorm. I want to begin with a few introductory remarks. First, as I have joined you each session, I now see why so many friends experience your community of Word and Life as such an important part of their life and faith. And clearly it takes a village of volunteers to make all of this happen. Thank you, you've been a great help to me in my own preparation. Secondly, let me say how much I've enjoyed Curry's book. He is a wonderful storyteller, and he tells his story with great humor, humility, and wisdom. What a gift he is to all people of faith and all persons seeking a more compassionate and peaceful world. Alongside the book, you have assembled an amazing group of speakers, each of whom have helped to deepen and enrich our experience and understanding of Curry's book. Third, I see Christianity as a big tent embracing many different tribes. In one corner is my tribe, Episcopalians. And within my tribe, there is glorious biblical and theological diversity. From where I stand in this big tent and in every direction I look, I know that there are good people of faith that will have a very different take than mine on God, let alone our sacred texts and traditions. This big tent, I believe, is both a gift and a challenge. As important as our religious beliefs and values are, equally and perhaps more importantly, is how we listen to and care for one another, especially when we disagree. This gets to the heart of one of the core themes of Curry's book. How can we be models of God's way of love by listening generously and respectfully? There are precious few models of this in our world today. Fourth, I can see how and why I was asked to speak on these two chapters, as Michael alluded. As you recall, these two chapters tell the story of Curry's own transformation of understanding and support of our LGBTQ sisters and brothers. Additionally, Curry tells us of his own evolution in leading during times of conflict, how to hold on to controversial beliefs while making a space for compassion and respectful listening. So for those of you who don't know me, in my rush to write a blurb for you about myself, I left out that for much, but not all of my adult life and ministry, I have been a minister who is out and proud about being gay. Why is being out and proud about being gay important? First of all, I have faced the cost of my own internalized homophobia, a profound and deep personal rejection of that part of my God-given humanity. Secondly, and tragically, all too often, religion has been the voice of hate and rejection that has caused congregations and families to choose between their understanding of God and their children. In spite of all our progress and justice, for too long, the highest form of death for our LGBTQ children and youth has been suicide. How can we be silent? This has led me to be an advocate for healing and reconciliation with our LGBTQ sisters and brothers, especially those who have been rejected by much of institutional religion. I certainly understand their anger and rejection of a God they have experienced as hate and told they are an abomination. I have also sought to be a bridge to other faith communities seeking to raise awareness and justice around issues of human sexuality. So given my life journey and ministry, I am grateful that you asked me to reflect on these two chapters. My talk is divided into two unequal parts, and we will have a brief pause in the middle in order to have some relief from my talking head. In the first part, I will draw on different examples that demonstrate what the way of love looks like for me. The second part will be about how to stay grounded in God's love in order to do the work of the way of love. So as I begin, let us pray. Gracious and loving God, help us to draw from your deep river of compassion and mercy, the endless and varied source of your love. As we drink from the waters of life, we are strengthened and nurtured. Help us to draw deeply from your river of love as we seek to help building your dream of love and justice for our lives and for your world. Amen. So part one, what does the way of love look like? How do I see God's gloriously wide and diverse way of love? As Christians, we are challenged by millennia of enmity between the different religions of the world. Does it make sense today that one religion seeks advantage and conversion over the other, as if one of us has more or all of the truth? In my view, our religious divisions are further pushing the world to its limits. And it is time for Christians, along with all people of faith, to see one another differently. When all of our religions are at their best, we share a common hope for compassion, love, peace, and justice. And if this is true, and I believe it is, then how do we hold on to our Christian identity and traditions while embracing our sisters and brothers from other religions? In her writings, the feminist Christian theologian Sally McFaig says that for many of us, so many of our biblical images have at best lost their salt. She suggests we need to add new metaphors and images of God. In that light, from his book, One River, Many Wells, Matthew Fox writes, "To connect with the great river, we all need a path. But when you get down there, there's only one river." All the world's religions are their own paths to the river. Given this new paradigm, how do we honor and support one another's different paths as we share the one river? I hear in Curry's book a clear acknowledgement of this emerging ecumenical and interreligious reality calling us. In that light, let me tell you a personal Michael Curry story that exemplifies this. My story takes place a few months after he had been elected presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church in 2015. He was invited to speak at our diocesan convention held in Ontario that December. We gathered that weekend just a few days and a few miles away from the brutal murder in San Bernardino of 16 persons in an act of terrorism by an Islamic extremist. Even 6 years later, I can remember how tense and afraid we all were. This awful act reverberated around the world. There were calls for revenge and accountability. Patriotism, tribalism on all sides was at an all-time high. Within a few days of that horrific event, Michael Curry spoke to us and shared a story that, as it turned out, we all were desperate to hear. The story Curry told us was how the Muslims and Christians of Albania saved the Jews of Albania during the Second World War. A timely story, a reminder of how we might see the world differently today. After hearing Bishop Curry's story, I wanted to learn more. Of the many resources, the most compelling was the account from Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. Part of Yad Vashem's mission is to authenticate the stories of those non-Jews who saved Jews during the Holocaust. They are called the righteous among the nations. For more than a millennia, Albania has been a religiously diverse nation of majority Muslims alongside Roman Catholic Christians, Orthodox Christians, and a small Jewish community. As Curry shared that day, when Albania was occupied by the Nazi forces, the Albanian authorities were ordered to turn over the Jews. Albanian leaders refused to cooperate and issued false identity papers, which helped shield the Jewish community. With their false papers, the Jewish families of Albania lived with other Christian and Muslim families in scattered villages and towns, where everyone knew who they were and where they were. When the Nazis searched house to house for the Jews, Albanians helped hide their Jewish guests as if they were family. For years, this went on until the war was over. And unlike the rest of largely Christian Europe, where millions of Jews were turned over and killed in concentration camps, majority Muslim Albania is the only country in Europe where there were more Jews after the war than before. Muslim Albanians had an honor code known as Besa, which means to keep the promise of hospitality and protection of guests, as if they were members of one's own family. In fact, all of our religions have a similar golden rule. For Jews in the Talmud, if one saved a life, it would be as if one saved all humanity. For Christians, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. Also around the time of Curry's talk, there was another story, this time more current. This dramatic story took place in rural Kenya. A bus was filled with Muslims and Christians when it was attacked by Al-Shabaab terrorists. The terrorists stopped the bus and ordered everyone off and into two separate groups of Muslims and Christians. After separating them, the terrorists planned to kill the Christians. The Muslims of the bus defied the terrorists by placing the Christians in the center of their group. The Muslims of the bus told the terrorists they were prepared to die together with the Christians. They would have to kill them all or leave them all alone. Except one who tried to run, all lived. Isn't this a 21st century example of Bessa? Isn't this your experience of our Muslim sisters and brothers here in Santa Barbara? As in the vast, vast majority of over a billion Muslims around the world, this is the true face of Islam. ISIS, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram are tragically distorted and twisted views of Islam, much like white supremacists, the KKK, or Nazism are distorted and twisted views of Christianity. Alongside this image of the One River from Fox, let me draw upon the wisdom of the second century Christian saint, Irenaeus. Irenaeus famously wrote, "The glory of God is the human being fully alive." What is not often heard is the following sentence, "And to be fully alive consists in beholding God." Can we say then that what animates God is that we seek, however imperfectly, to open our hearts to the divine? Then this fundamentally changes how we see the world. God delights in all creation and humanity becoming fully alive. Then we are invited to consider how we become stewards of this way of love for ourselves, for all people and creation. Let me share with you briefly my own journey from homophobia to wholeness, health, and joy, or as Irenaeus puts it, how I become more fully alive. In my adolescence and early years of ministry, I lived with a self-built wall between my sexual orientation and God. This was the only choice I felt I could make. At first, I tried to discipline to control it. Then, because control wasn't working, I tried praying to change it. And then when that didn't work, my longtime mentor asked me to try an exorcism, and sadly, I agreed. And when that didn't work, the exorcist said I was left with discipline and a life of celibacy. This trajectory is all too common for my sisters and brothers, a trajectory of discipline or prayer and exorcism, and leaves us sad and depressed. And for me, I had nearly lost all joy as a child of God. So I tried the one and only thing left to me, and that was seeking acceptance of my sexuality. And I experienced an instant peace. I had a growing realization that I had been wasting so much time and energy trying to suppress and change and control what was unchangeable. At first, this was a truce between God and my sexual orientation. Eventually, with prayer, study, time, and therapy, the truth was transformed. I began to see that my sexual orientation was a gift from God, part of what made me a child of God. And if I'm a child of God, then I am also made in the image of the divine. And if that is true, then that makes my sexual orientation part of the divine equation. Now I saw my sexual orientation as a gift. For many varied reasons, especially if they have come from a fundamentalist tradition, many LGBTQ folk who are able to embrace their sexual orientation still see religion and God as their enemy. And I understand that. What was powerful in the two chapters we read for today was how Michael Curry confronted his own blindness to the LGBTQ community. Do you remember the story of Jason his young organist. With humility and vulnerability, Curry shared his own blindness to Jason. Why didn't he see Jason? Why didn't he want to know more about Jason? As I reflected on Jason and Curry, in my own imagination, I could feel Curry's struggle, but I could also feel his wall of denial. We've all been Jason, and we've all been Michael Curry. The question for us today is who might be sitting right in front of us. For example, how do we care for and support the person who is exploring their gender identity? How do we care for and support their parents, families, and friends? Today, we read with sad regularity the stories of our transgender sisters and brothers being accosted and unwelcomed by their families, friends, and communities of faith. How is it different from when we didn't understand the journeys of our lesbian and gay sisters and brothers years ago? As Curry told his story of transformation about human sexuality, he reminded us of the work we all need to do. We have new work to do in welcoming, understanding, and caring for our transgender and gender non-conforming sisters and brothers. As Curry gave us the example, this work asks of us individually and collectively. He reminds us of the work we all need to do. We need to do work to do in welcoming, understanding, and caring for our transgender and gender non-conforming sisters and brothers. As Curry gave us the example, this work asks of us individually and collectively deep listening, prayer, and reevaluation of our sacred texts and traditions while drawing upon the best wisdom of experts. In this new work, I hear the hope of Irenaeus. The glory of God is the human being fully alive. And to be fully alive consists in holding God and beholding God. Let us pledge individually and collectively to do this work, which is the way of love. Now let us take a few seconds to take a break from my talking head. Don't go away. This won't be long, but take a moment to shake your hands or stand up, whatever you can do. Okay. Now, part two. How do we stay grounded in God's love? Why is our grounding in God's love essential to staying on the way of love? Curry reminds us of this work at the beginning of chapter 9 with this quote from Joy Harho, who writes, the door of the mind should only open from the heart. An enemy who gets in risks the danger of becoming a friend. In this chapter, Curry shared his own struggle with how to be a faithful leader during difficult and controversial times. Curry summarizes the challenge for us individually and collectively when he asks, how do we listen to each other, pray for each other, love each other, and discern together to hear what the Spirit might be saying to the church? Earlier in his book, in chapter 4, Curry drew on the nonviolent justice work of Martin Luther King Jr. Curry told the story that when King would ask others to join him on marches or in nonviolent protests, he would ask them to sign a pledge card entitled The Ten Commandments of Nonviolence. Of King's Ten Commandments, 9 were spiritual principles that King felt would help the marchers stay grounded in the nonviolent way of love. The first commandment was, meditate daily on the teachings and life of Christ. Curry went on to say, Dr. King realized that to walk the way of love, we need to nurture a relationship with the source of love. There are an infinite number of ways to nurture and stay connected to the source of love, Curry says. But Curry concludes, commit to holding space for it daily. We are just a few weeks away, as we were reminded, from the end of the series, and in the last session, you will work on your own personal rule of life. Curry calls it Love in Action, a daily planner. I will leave that for the excellent guides that follow, but I would like to start by priming the pump a little. In light of Curry's invitation to develop a rule of life, let me share some wisdom from Matthew Fox and Richard Rohr that I find helpful. Matthew Fox reminds us, we must work on our souls, enlarging and expanding them. We do so by experiencing all of life, the beauty and the joy, as well as the grief and pain. Soul work requires paying attention to life, to the laughter and the sorrow, the enlightening and the frightening, the inspiring and the silly. In doing this soul work, Fox suggests that this work begins with non-dualistic thinking. Many of us are followers of Richard Rohr, and he describes non-dual knowing this way. Non-dual knowing is living in the naked now, the sacrament of the present moment. This consciousness will teach us how to actually experience our experiences, whether good or bad or ugly, and how to let them transform us. Living in the naked now is this soul work. It is staying connected to the source of love. I know I'm stating the obvious, but this work is daily work, heart work. I'm sure many of you already have a daily practice, a time that works best for you in the rhythm of your day. For me, it's early in the morning before the rest of my household, my husband and dogs wake up. I love the early morning, but finding the best time for you may be different. I have my morning ritual, and it has changed and evolved over time. With my cup of coffee, I sit in the living room on my sofa for about 30 to 45 minutes of what I call heart work. My intention, however imperfectly realized, is to be resting in God's love. The first part is intercessory prayer. I imagine it like in the Eucharist or communion, where we call on the communion of the saints to gather around the altar with us. I imagine in my intercessory time of prayer, the communion of saints gathered around me as I sit there. I imagine them holding them in love as we rest in God. It's a time of holding my family and friends, living and dead, the details of their lives, while holding lightly onto outcomes. It's a time where I imagine holding them in the love, in the now and eternity of God's love. Then I have about 20 minutes for meditation. And for me, I describe meditation again as resting in God. And even as I am endlessly interrupted by my restless mind, I return ever so gently to my intention of resting in God's love. Please remember, as Curry said, there are any number of ways to hold the intention to have that daily connection to the source of love. These next few sessions may be a time for you to take a thoughtful and prayerful look at your own spiritual life and trust what is bubbling to the surface for you to look at. Beside our spiritual practices, another thing I am invited us to reflect on is our experiences of God and how they have shaped our lives of faith. Do you remember Curry's experience in his college dorm room, where in his bed he tossed and turned with anxiety and concern for his friend he had taken to the infirmary that night? Curry writes, "That night, with my friend in the infirmary, my world was shaken by something I didn't see coming. I was cracked open, if you will, vulnerable. On my knees that night, I felt God, who the Bible says is love. In a book about discernment, grounded in God, the authors write about experiences of God this way. Throughout the Bible and throughout the history of the church, God has spoken to people through dreams and visions. A vision is a kind of spontaneous image, a dream that occurs while we are awake. They come not from the head, but emerge from the depths with great strength. They tend to have an indelible quality. They are symbolic and, when explored for meaning, often bear a clear message. Thomas Merton, the great mystic of the last century, writes about his experience standing on a sidewalk in the busy downtown of Louisville, Kentucky. Many of you have heard this account. He wrote, "In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all those people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, as if the sorrows and stupidities of the human condition could overwhelm me. Now I realize what we all are. And if only everybody could realize this. But it cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun." Merton went on to reflect on this experience. "At the center of every being is a point of nothingness which is untouched by sin and illusion, a point of pure truth, a point of spark which belongs entirely to God. It is like a pure diamond blazing with the invisible light of heaven. It is in everybody. And if we could see it, we would see the billions of points of light coming together in the face and blaze of a sun that would make all the darkness and cruelty of life vanish completely. I have no program for this seeing," he says. "It is only given. It is only a given. But the gate of heaven is everywhere." In closing, let me share one last personal story of a gate, if you will. It's a story that took place in the late 70s when I was discerning a call to serve a small rural congregation in the Sacramento Valley. The congregation had been through some very difficult years. I was invited by the vestry to come on a Saturday for an interview and preach the next morning. When I arrived that Saturday, my snobby, shallow aesthetic, my inner Martha Stewart, if you will, was crushed by what I saw. The church building was built in the 1950s out of concrete cinder blocks painted white. On the inside, the floor was covered with red linoleum. The pews were made by helping hands out of what looked like a high grade of plywood that had been unattractively vanished to a bright shine that almost required sunglasses. I could go on with my disappointment. But the next morning, I arrived early before anyone else. And in the quiet of the early morning light, I stood in the back of the church, recalling my many disappointments from the day before. Then, for the briefest of moments, I became aware that there was this soft glow coming from the tabernacle where the reserved sacrament was kept. As I became aware of this soft light, I also had a sense of these words to me: "I want you to see these people and this place as I see them." It was a brief, quiet and humbling moment of pure gift, of pure grace, and of wonderment My 4 years in Oroville were wonderful years in the life of that congregation. And only in the way of God's sense of humor, it was also in Oroville that I began to put my life together with my sexuality and faith. It was in Oroville where I began to see that what I had wanted to wall off was actually a gift from God. It was in Oroville where I began to love that part of me that God had always loved. Who knew that? But Oroville changed the trajectory of my life and ministry. Why am I sharing this experience with you? Because in risking such a personal story, I hope that you will recall those moments of grace that have transformed your lives and changed your trajectory. The divine river of love is both in us and all around us, and in the mystery of love beyond. In the next few minutes, I would like you to join me in sitting in quiet to reflect on one of two questions. Either your spiritual practice, what it is, how you experience it, and how it feeds you. Or I invite you to remember a time when you have sensed an outpouring or indwelling of the divine, however big or small, how and why it transformed your way of love. So please take a moment to reflect on one of those questions. And I will hold the 2 minutes before I turn you over to Tim. So please reflect on those two questions in the silence. Thank you. And now over to Tim.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for sharing your story and such a beautiful encouragement for us this morning.